What is up, Bitcoiners? We are back with another episode of FedWatch. It's me and Ansel once again, and we have quite the update for you. We got a lot happening in the global sphere, but we are mostly going to be focusing on China before we talk about Bitcoin going all the way up. I mean, where is Ansel, by the way? I don't see him.
I'm here. Can you see me?
Oh, there we
go. What's up, guys? What's up, Christian?
Ansel, how you doing?
Good, man. Yeah, so another exciting episode of FedWatch on deck here. Like you said, China update. Then we'll jump into Bitcoin, perhaps bottoming. So we have some Bitcoin charts, and then we'll end up with the Euro. Some other admin updates for us. I started a new FedWatch Clips channel, which I will link in the show notes to this. And as soon as I get figured out how to put longer clips onto Twitter, those will be going up as well on Twitter. But there you can see the new channel. Already have 20 subscribers. So if you're listening live, go on over to FedWatch Clips and subscribe. And of course, driving traffic back to the Bitcoin Magazine standalone episode. But
I want to give a shout out to our new music.
I'm a big fan.
Good choice, Ansel.
Yeah, we got some new music, working on some intros to make it a little bit more listener friendly to people. Because as Bitcoin's bottoming, I think we're going to have a new flood of interest into the space. And I think making this podcast a little bit more listener friendly will be good. Hopefully we can get our numbers up. So please, listeners, share, subscribe to the new YouTube channel, and let's get our listener base up.
So before we get into the show, I want to give a quick shill to Bitcoin Amsterdam. I heard some blasphemy on the last interview, but ticket prices are going up this Friday. So you really don't have any time. Buy your tickets right now. Ticket prices are going up, and you're going to want to get your ticket right now. It's 349 euros for the GA ticket. Sorry, 249 euros for the GA ticket, 2099 euros for our VIP whale ticket. And it's going to be a lot of fun in Amsterdam, y'all. We have a great speaker lineup for you guys. And October is a beautiful time to be in the Netherlands. We got Alex Gladstein, Adam Back, Pierre Richard, Matt Odell, Giacomo Zucco, Nuxel, I can't pronounce the Nuts last name, but Lena Sheets, and many more to be announced. So working on some big names over at Bitcoin Amsterdam. So go get your hotels, get your flights, get your tickets. It's going to be a great time. And for those who are concerned, all the main content will be in English. So for the Americans, great time to go to vacation, great time to go to Europe. You could even do a Bitcoin Europe tour between Riga, what's happening in France, and then in the UK. And then finally, what we're doing in Amsterdam. A lot of Bitcoining is happening in Europe. And gosh, they need it. They need Bitcoin in Europe more than most developed countries. So don't forget to go to bit.tc/conference/Amsterdam. Get your tickets today before ticket prices go up on Friday. Ansel, you went to Jekyll Island. What was that like?
Yeah, so yesterday went to Jekyll Island, the famous in the like economics sphere, I guess you could say. People that study the Federal Reserve and stuff like that. That's where the bankers got together back in 1910 to design the current Central Bank of the United States, or Federal Reserve. And I just lived down the road. So I moved to Florida, Jacksonville area, about 3 years ago, and I wanted to go visit Jekyll Island. And I went there for the day with my family and got to teach my kids all about the Federal Reserve. And hey, this is where it was kind of created in the shadows. And yeah, we visited the Jekyll Island Club, very nice place that just to give a little example, they had a croquet field, manicured croquet field, and people playing in all white. So that's the type of club resort that it is there. They also have a golf course and all that. But yeah, it was interesting to go see that.
Jekyll Island is the birthplace of all of this fiat madness. So I think it's important for people to know about the history. There's a great book called The Creature from Jekyll Island. So I really recommend everyone to go check that out. And it's important to know history. I'm here in Nashville. The other day, I was actually hanging out with my wife's uncle, and he is a huge history buff. And he had been touring all around the South, checking out Civil War battlefields and other memorials there. So knowing history is so important because it helps guide you how things might happen into the future. Of course, it doesn't always repeat, but it sure often does rhyme. And there's a lot of lessons and wisdom from history. So I think it is really important for people to understand what happened in the past. And hopefully we can avoid remaking those mistakes, but I'm not that hopeful that we'll avoid those mistakes. Human beings tend to have a pretty short memory.
Well, yeah. Also, if you guys want to see the images from my trip, you can go to join the Telegram group. It's Bitcoin and Markets. Just search for it. I will link to it in the show notes too. Trying to get that bootstrapped, a new Telegram channel for people. And you can see all the manicured lawns and all the hoity-toity people that go to Jekyll Island Resort. But yeah, it was a fun trip. Should we jump right into China now? Or what do you
want? Yeah, I was going to say, let's pivot from talking about what's happening in the U.S. and let's talk about China. A lot is happening in China.
Absolutely. So the Chinese housing market continues to struggle. We talked about this, probably the first in Bitcoin for sure. Maybe one of the first in macro podcasts to talk about Evergrande and some of the real estate troubles over there in China. It continues to expand. Now, out of the top 100 developers, real estate developers in China, 28 have either defaulted or restructured their debt. And probably the other 72 out of the top 100 are in trouble, right? You can't have the top two real estate developers defaulting and the rest of the market is going to be okay. So it's a real big problem over there. Let's see, the mortgage boycott. So recently, you probably have seen some headlines about this. It started small with about 20 projects, 20 of these high-rise projects, where the new owners are boycotting making payments on their mortgages. So through COVID and through the credit crisis that they're having now, these projects aren't even being built actively anymore. And the way that they usually do it over there in China, from my understanding, is that they pre-sale all of these units and then they build them in a couple years and then they can move in later. But now all these developments have stopped being built and there is a mortgage boycott. So like I said, it started with about 20 projects and it has now increased to 230, at least 230 of these high-rise projects have joined this mortgage boycott. And out of all mortgages in China, it's still small, about 0.1% of all mortgages. So they say it's about 100,000 households are refusing to pay these mortgages, but it is a little bit higher in the mortgage value. So about 1% of all mortgage value in China is boycotting making payments, and it's growing. So,
well, the thing is that when the way that the fiat system is set up and the amount of leverage that's in the system and the amount of kind of dependencies that are out there, it's like, yeah, it's 1%, but you know, if that becomes 5%, then all of a sudden it becomes a systemic problem because that's how fragile it all is.
Yeah, and some of the rhetoric is extremely similar to 2007 in the United States, where they say, oh, it's a small problem. It's contained to a small segment of the market. It's not going to affect things. I mean, it's kind of eerie, the similarities in what the officials are saying about this problem. Real estate's huge in China. It makes up about 25% of their GDP, 20% of bank assets are real estate assets and like mortgages and stuff. And the Chinese banks have a total of about $9 trillion worth of exposure to the real estate sector. So the real estate sector in China is bigger than the United States stock market and it's facing a credit crisis. So this could really affect the global economy. Let's see, I have a chart here. And that's the second one, or slide number three. I'm not watching the screen. Is that up on the screen now? There we go. Okay.
I've been looking at this chart the whole time.
Sorry, I was looking at my notes. I wasn't looking at the screen. So yeah, this shows that we are in the 10th month in a row of negative prices for new units over there in China. And what struck me about this chart was the kind of cyclicality you can see in the preceding years, where it looks like towards the second half of the year, the housing market cools off each year in China. And I'm not sure if that has to do with the flood season or the wet season, or maybe the Chinese New Year or something, but it does look like at the end, the second half of the year slows down. And so that's a bad sign if already at the beginning of the year, we're in negative territory for the real estate market over there. It could just continue to get worse. The next slide I have is the Chinese GDP. And Christian, of course,
the lower lows, man. Scary.
Yeah. Yeah, Christian, just stop me anytime.
Break
me off, because I can just keep rattling this stuff off. So yeah, this is a chart of GDP and CPI. The CPI is not all that important for our discussion here, but the GDP had a print last quarter, so Q2, of 0.4%. And what struck me about this chart is you can see from the great financial crisis back in 08, it's been trending downward. And that's part of my whole macro theory, is we're just going to return to low growth, low inflation environment. And China is kind of leading the way possibly in this. We did have, of course, the disruption there with COVID, but now we're just returning to a slowly having lower growth, including in China. So any comments on this chart, Christian?
I mean, it's interesting to see it all together, right? So the trend is kind of intact, and outside of just COVID, it's just been getting less and less. So seeing that stagnation, it's kind of crazy. You've been talking about how China has been fueled by all of this debt that has kind of been circulating. And as that unwinds, who's the first victim? It's China. And you can see in the chart.
Absolutely. So this year they have a 5% goal for GDP. And if they want to achieve that, the second half of the year has to be a 7% growth rate. And it does not look like they're anywhere close to getting that. But you also have to think about a little bit larger perspective on this, because they have the 20th Party Congress coming up later this year. And that is where Xi is going to be crowned emperor of China, pretty much, where he is going to be perpetually at the head of the CCP. And if they're facing really bad financial crisis, as well as crashing GDP, when, you know, is he going to get crowned? Is he going to get the next term as chairman of the Communist Party? We'll see. But this is an important year. And I don't know, if I were his political enemy, I would just not try to fix anything, not get in the way, and let it all collapse. So I think that there is some argument to be made for China to really experience a big financial crisis from a political perspective, not just a macro perspective. So yeah, that can lead us.
Do you have any insight into like what the political rhetoric in China is like? And I'm assuming that not everyone is just bowing down to the CCP, although obviously the techno-authoritarianism is pretty powerful and scary.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on China or anything like that, but I do know that the Xi has gone through several purges in the Communist Party, where he's really taken out any of his competition, any people that are kind of rising up and having influence, he's taken them out already. So he has very tight control over the entire country. And the zero COVID policy, I think, demonstrates that. So you've probably seen some videos of people walking on the tarmacs over there in different airports in China, and they have their suit on and they're spraying some solution on the tarmac of the airport. I don't know, I saw that the other day. And people are like, wow, this is just crazy over there. But really, what they're doing is they're proving their loyalty, right? They're proving their loyalty that they will do something so ridiculous and they won't question the authorities. And so, yeah, Xi does have a tight iron grip over there, but it's all going to come to a head later this year at the 20th Party Congress. So it will be quite exciting.
So when is the Congress again?
I'm not sure. I think October sometime, but I would have to look that up exactly when it is.
So coming pretty quickly here.
Yeah, it's coming up this year. Okay,
Hey, keep an eye out for October in China. We'll keep you all up to date. Next story.
Yeah, so it just keeps getting worse, though. Like the problem, what I want to try to build a narrative of, it's slow rolling, but you know, it's gradually then suddenly. And another thing we're seeing over there in China recently is these bank runs. And I have an article that I wanted to read off for that. Let's make sure that's pulled up. There you go. And let's get into this. So this is by Yupei. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. He's a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. And this was in Nikkei Asia just a couple days ago. So here we go. Confidence in the safety of Chinese banks has been badly shaken by the failure of several small banks in Henan province in April this year. In terms of their assets of about 40 billion yuan, that's $6 billion, and the number of customers, roughly 400,000, the shuttered rural banks are minions in the China's financial system. So they're not that big yet, but smaller things can snowball into bigger things. The explosion of these poorly supervised and likely corruption-ridden financial institutions should not be surprising. But how local authorities handled the fallout is shocking, even in the most jaded even for the most jaded observers of the Chinese political scene. Instead of compensating the depositors, who were entitled up to 500,000 yuan, according to government regulations, officials in Hainan have done everything imaginable to silence them. They initially restricted the movement of the depositors by turning the COVID test code on their smartphones red, which effectively made it impossible for them to take public transportation or even drive their own cars. A public outcry forced the Hainan government to abandon this abusive tactic. That sounds a little bit like Canada or Australia or even some European countries. Anyways, but when several hundred depositors unable to gain access to their savings in the failed banks gathered on July 10th to protest in front of the People's Bank branch office in Shenzhou, the capital of Hainan, local officials sent in a large number of thugs who viciously assaulted the depositors, with uniformed police officers looking on. Ever since China began to binge on debt to fuel its growth in 2009, many have wondered how long the party could go on. And I've argued that it's been going, they didn't just start in 2009. China was built on at least 20 or 30 years of a credit bubble. To the chagrin of many bearish observers, predictions of a financial crisis have not panned out. Today, China's banking system is still standing despite a debt-to-GDP ratio of 264%. Perhaps because Beijing seems to be able to defy financial gravity, fewer people these days worry that its ballooning debt could unleash a systemic crisis. But there are many warning signs indicating that China may face a debt reckoning soon. Weak supervision, poor risk management, and corruption that likely drove the small rural banks in Hainan into insolvency are systemic among the country's nearly 4,000 small and medium-sized banks, with nearly $14 trillion in assets. If a large number of small banks fail together, such an event could produce a chain reaction threatening the stability of the financial sector. Their counterparties and lenders, especially bigger banks, could suffer massive losses. Confidence in China's shadow banking system, though, through which small banks attract funds with a higher interest rate, will likely evaporate. The chances of such a financial meltdown are much higher today than before. One of the reasons that China has avoided a financial crisis in the last decade is that its economy managed to grow at a reasonably higher rate, averaging 6.8% a year from 2011 to 2020. A faster growing economy normally makes it easier to manage or even conceal the debt burden. But as the Chinese economy is now slowing down rapidly, in part due to Beijing's zero COVID policy, the debt bomb is ticking much louder. The most obvious warning light is clearly China's debt-ridden real estate sector, and that's what we talked about just a minute ago. China's debt-laden local governments are now facing grim prospects, declining income from land sales because of this crisis in the real estate sector, and falling tax receipts are expected to cause a 6 trillion yuan shortfall, roughly $900 billion, in local government revenues this year. Local government financing vehicles that have borrowed heavily from banks or issued bonds will have great difficulties servicing their debt. And almost done here. Large banks in China are in trouble as well. They have lent tens of billions to poor countries as part of China's ambitious Belt and Road Initiative. A significant portion of their credit portfolio is likely to become non-performing as their borrowers are unable to service the debt due to the global economic downturn. The most recent economic implosion and collapse of the government of Sri Lanka will likely force their Chinese lenders to write off a large portion of the loans. If big Chinese banks themselves face rising non-performing loans abroad, they will be less able to help bail out insolvent small or medium-sized banks at home. It might be possible for China to dodge another financial meltdown this time, but if local officials have to hire thugs to attack bank customers trying to get their money back, investors should brace for far worse days ahead for China's banking sector. All right, and that does it. Christian, any comments on that?
Nothing. I have nothing good to say, man. Just it's insane to watch it happen. We've been calling it out here. We've even been calling out the pro-China rhetoric, this kind of idea that China is this rising power and the U.S. is this falling power, if anything. And even the likes of Ray Dalio have recently published this kind of idea. But when you look at the facts, you look at what's happening, like China is not thriving by any means. And I mean, it's sad. A lot of people are going to be affected. And it's really disgusting to see the authoritarian measures that have become acceptable across the world. And that's, I feel like, been perpetrated, been made popular by China. So I hate to see what is happening in the CCP. I hate seeing that getting exported. And simultaneously, it does not look like they're in a healthy position by any means.
Yeah, and I liked in that article, they mentioned the Belt and Road Initiative, because they have a lot of people, a lot of commentators say, oh yeah, China is de-dollarizing and they're being really smart with their investments. And they're going around the world and they're investing in all these places and building this Belt and Road Initiative, but they're non-performing. Okay, these countries are going to go bankrupt. They're going to seize back all of these things that China built for them, and thought it was great that they put that in there. All right, that's all I have for China, man. Do you want to roll into Bitcoin now?
Yeah, what a past like 24, 36 hours for Bitcoin. Really ripping. Yep. First, it was following whatever pump was happening in Ethereum, but today is just completely overtaking it as well. So I'm kind of curious what you're seeing in the chart.
All right, so let's pull up the next slide, please, is the Bitcoin chart here. This is a 4-hour chart. And I published this on Twitter and then again on my newsletter a couple weeks ago. And that is just showing that back in May, when we had, everyone kind of thought this might have been a bottom back in May. And then we went sideways. We had lower lows all along. Then we tried to break out of the red line back pretty much around June 1st. That failed. And then we had a lower high and that sold off. Now this time we had higher lows, which I think is very important to mention, and higher highs. So this is different fundamentally than the last time we tried to do this. If you go to the next chart, these are just the last three times that are very similar. So I drew the line, the red line, at the top of the bounce. So bounce off the bottom and then where we got to. And you can see that it failed back at the end of last year. Then it failed in May. But this one looks fundamentally different with higher lows and higher highs. So I do think there is a possibility that this is a fake out, but everything in the market that I'm seeing is showing that this is a real breakout and we could have bottomed for this cycle. Thoughts on that, Christian, before I go on?
Well, can you explain a little bit what you mean by bottomed? Because some people are like, oh, we bottomed and we're going up from here. And often my understanding of we bottomed is, hey, it's probably not going to go that much lower from here. It might have some spills, but for the most part, we're going to be consolidating here before finally making it back up.
Yeah. So yeah, by bottom, I mean the low is in, that it is very possible that the low is in and it won't go any lower from here. We might have consolidation, like you say, but this has bottomed and you won't see major capitulation sell-offs anymore. I do watch some of the altcoin saga that's going on with the liquidations and the bankruptcies and all that stuff from all these Ponzi schemes. I think that we have moved past the portion where they're liquidating their Bitcoins. We're moved into the lawyer aspect of this. We've moved into the bankruptcies where there's not going to be a lot of liquidations here, forced liquidations in the market. So a lot of these cascade waterfalls that we've seen over the last few months, I think will be much less likely to occur in this environment right now. So that's kind of what I'm looking at.
Okay. Well, I mean, personally for me, I'm not holding my breath. I'm preparing myself to continue to buy CHOP, continue to buy the blood. But, you know, if we boost up from here, I have a lot more Bitcoin than I have USD, even after the voting accident. So it's always exciting to see Bitcoin perform, but we're seeing other assets perform as well. So very interested to see, you know, how this is kind of tied into maybe Fed expectations or anything else that could be affecting the market.
Yeah. So if we go to the next slide, I know we're ripping through this stuff pretty quick here, but let's go to the next slide. And this is a tweet that I saw from Cuppy on Twitter, and it's showing a chart of cash positions by hedge funds. So at the peaks, it's showing that there is in their portfolio, they're holding more cash, and it does correspond with market bottoms. So he charted this out all the way back. We are at a high a local high that goes back to 2001. Their hedge funds have not been more in cash, even during the great financial crisis or anything, all the way back to 2001. And what happens when that reverses, right? When they go out of cash back into the market, we can see a big time rally. He's saying here that it's going to be violent to the upside. And I tend to believe that. I think a lot of people that are talking about Armageddon and there's going to be a 50% sell-off in the S&P and all this stuff, I think they're overselling it just a little bit. And it's likely, looking at this chart, that if these hedge funds do roll back into assets, which do include Bitcoin, I think we could see a major market rally here coming up. And if you go to the next slide, this is kind of what it looks like for Bitcoin. I used to call this Tether dominance on my newsletter. I haven't tracked this for about a year, but this is the top part of this chart is showing stable coins divided by the total market cap of crypto. That's Bitcoin and altcoins. And you can see that at the tops, when these stable coins are more dominant, then that's usually marks bottoms in the Bitcoin price. And then when it drops, because they rotate out of stable coins back into Bitcoin, we see that the bottoms being local tops. And it very much does coincide with the last chart on cash position. So this is kind of the cash position for the Bitcoin market. And as that rotates back out of the stable coins and back into Bitcoin, we could see a major rally in Bitcoin. So this is just adding to the technical analysis of the chart pattern, saying we have a little bit of a breakout here. And we are in a position where the money can rotate back in to pump the price. So, Shin, any comments on this? I know you're not a big TA guy.
No, but this is the kind of TA I do like, which is like comparing the market cap of one thing to the market cap of another and seeing how it makes sense within the market dynamic. So watching this is really interesting. I would love to get the link to this trading view chart here, but it is an excellent kind of like visualization and very interesting to see.
Yeah, this was from Will Clement III on Twitter. I will, of course, link to all this stuff in the show notes and have the appropriate things. So that's it, man. We can go into the dollar or the euro, unless you want to keep talking Bitcoin for a little bit.
Well, let's talk dollar a little bit. I mean, again, I think that there's two really interesting, strong, I would say like there's a dominant narrative and then there's like the counter narrative. The dominant narrative is like we're experiencing inflation, and then there's a counter narrative, which you have really been sticking to and educating us, myself and the reader and the listeners about, which is like the strong dollar thesis and this idea that it's very difficult to see inflation and that the way that the dollar works with debt and in the global economy with shadow banks and gray banking in euro dollars, there's a massive demand for dollars and actually dollars are screeching up. It's very interesting to see dollars screeching up and simultaneously prices on real goods going up simultaneously. It's difficult for inflationists, at least dollar inflationists. I think it's difficult to argue that there isn't inflation across the globe, but not dollar inflation per se. So I'm going to shut up. Maybe you talk a little bit about just this strong dollar thesis in general, your thinking around that, and maybe we can go from there.
Yeah. So I don't argue that there is no money printing. There is no actual inflation, but there isn't enough to expand and grow the economy. So in a credit-based system, and this is the part that I really want to impress on people, is that we don't have a fiat system. We have a credit-based system. So all the money in your bank account or your dollar account, anybody in Hong Kong that has a US dollar denominated account or Tokyo or Frankfurt or anywhere, that's debt. That's not fiat. That's someone else's debt. There's counterparty risk to that dollar. Those dollars exist on the balance sheets of banks. So it's a virtual currency that lives on balance sheets of banks. Now if you go back to the school book definition of fractional reserve banking, when you make a loan and that person needs to pay off the loan with the interest, right? So you take out a $100 loan, you have to pay back $110 if there's 10% interest, say. And to do that, you need to have more than $100 in the economy. So for everyone to stay solvent in a credit base, the amount of dollars needs to continue to expand. So I'm not arguing that isn't happening. I'm arguing that they're, the thing is, it's not when they do QE and they do all these other things that the, that's not money printing. The expansion of the credit supply, that is money printing, but it doesn't necessarily equal growth. So the economy has to grow and print more money to continue to inflate. But the overall debt burden, the overall pressure in the economy, once you get to a certain point, is deflationary. It adds a pressure on that credit bubble to deflate. And what that, when that happens, you, the money supply shrinks. And we have these deflationary shocks. And that's what we experience in these financial crises, what we talked about in China, the starting to experience right now, what we experienced back in the great financial crisis, what Europe experienced during the European debt crisis. These are deflationary moves, this deflationary pressure. And that's how this system is going to end. It will not end in an inflationary manner. Did I answer the question, Christian?
I think you did really do a good job of answering the question. And again, I think it's important too to say that when it comes to the dollar and then when it comes to other nation state fiat currencies, they really operate differently. The dollar is like the foundation in which all of them clear value and write contracts. And then everything else on top of that is more paper. It's effectively derivative paper on top of whatever, however their economy interacts with the dollar. How do you feel about that explanation or statement?
I think that's true. I think that they will suffer higher price increases because, yeah, the entire global financial system is based off dollars. Even if they say, oh, only 60% of global reserves, which the number is about 62% of global reserves are held in dollars. That's why it's a global reserve currency, that they say, oh, well, the dollar is losing dominance, but really the dollar backs the euro. They hold foreign currency on the balance sheet. And that foreign currency, the most important one, is the dollar. So the dollar backs even all of its competitors. And in a system where the dollar's strengthening, the weaker economies are going to have a harder time to make ends meet, to service that debt that they owe in dollars. Because remember, all dollars are debt. And if you hold dollars and you, there is a debt somewhere that needs to get paid for that dollar to continue to exist. So yeah, that's what I would say about the kind of dynamics between onshore dollars in the US economy and dollars offshore and other fiat currencies, quote unquote fiat currencies, they're credit-based currencies. All currencies are credit-based at this time. Of course, other than say Bitcoin, or if we went onto a gold standard, those are commodity-backed currencies. But all like national currencies today are based on credit. They're not technically fiat. And I want to maybe pull that apart a little bit more. So the reason why they're not fiat is because the government can't simply print money. The US government cannot print money. They actually borrow that money that they spend in government spending. So that money is coming from somewhere, right? The money is printed in a process of making a loan at a commercial bank to the economy, either bank to bank lending, or it can be bank to business lending or bank to individual lending. That's where the money printing is happening. The government is just pulling that money forward out of savings and spending it today. So that's why it feels like there's money printing, and why there is price rises, because you have demand being pulled forward by these government entities. So that, just to clarify that a little bit.
Let's jump into this dollar chart here. I mean, again, we talked about the dollar screaming up. And I've seen the comments about Bitcoin screaming up. Well, the dollar is actually screaming up. So if you look at the dollar index chart here, you can see really going parabolic, Ansel.
Yeah. And I've mentioned this on a standalone episode, I believe, with FedWatch, where we looked at the parabolic move in the dollar. And I said, we can't tell where the top is going to be, but we know that the timing is getting close to the end of this rally, because it can't go up forever. It has to stop at some point. And it's going to stop when that gets really vertical. So we have had a pullback here recently, testing this kind of trend, this parabolic trend. I kind of predicted maybe 112, 115 on the DXY. So we might have one more push higher, but I do not think we'll see a sell-off in the dollar, because everybody needs dollars to pay their debt around the world. So I think we're just moved into a new higher range. If you zoom out on this chart, which I don't think I included. If you zoom out on this chart for the last, say, 20 years, you'll see that the dollar is just stair-stepping higher. There's volatility within a range, but then it stair-steps up to a new higher range and has some volatility there. And now it's stair-stepping up to another range. So that's what I think is going on with the dollar. I also want to point out that a lot of people say, oh, if the dollar's getting stronger, Bitcoin cannot rally. Because it's, if the dollar's getting, Bitcoin is a inflation hedge. But that's not what we have seen in the history of Bitcoin. The dollar, like I said, has been stair-stepping higher. And Bitcoin has also been stair-stepping higher. It's just delayed a little bit. So that's important to mention, because a strong dollar does not mean a weak.
Yeah, I mean, in your theory, and I guess Michael Saylor and some others will also agree with the sentiment, is that we have a strong dollar and a strong Bitcoin short to medium term.
Yes. Another thing, the rising dollar can symbolize this dollar shortage. And that's what Jeff Schneider talks about a lot, a dollar shortage. And I like to call it just a monetary shortage. There's a shortage of money value out there, not even money units, but value of money, liquidity in the market. And so as the dollar goes into a higher range, stair-stepping up in, it's getting stronger and stronger over the last 12, 15 years, then there is a drought in liquid monetary value in the world. So Bitcoin can come in and fill that role. So as the dollar goes up, that's actually showing that there's more room for Bitcoin to come in and grab that unserved market niche of where the dollar isn't serving that liquidity need. Bitcoin can come in and serve that. So that's why Bitcoin and the dollar, I believe, will increase at the same time. I also think eventually gold will join. Gold has been having a rough time the last couple months, but eventually gold will join Bitcoin and the dollar going higher, because it is a monetary drought that we're living.
So gold is coming up higher. I mean, gold is still, has it been struggling? I haven't really been paying attention, to be honest, to gold.
Oh yeah, gold is not looking good right now. It's about 10% down from the 2011 high. So if you go back all the way to the beginning of Bitcoin, gold has been down over Bitcoin's life pretty much, versus Bitcoin, of course, up tens of thousands of percent. So, but eventually that will change, because like I said, there's a monetary drought and Bitcoin is benefiting from that. The dollar is also benefiting from that, and gold eventually will join the party, but we'll see when that happens.
So I guess like one of the big losers in when you, your next chart here is Euro versus USD. For the first time in my memory, Euro is effectively equal to the dollar. Do you want to talk a little bit about the significance of this? And then maybe we can talk about some of the things that are happening in Europe and why we think Europe needs Bitcoin, obviously.
Yeah, so let's see this chart on the Euro. It is quite inverse to the DXY, because the largest portion of the DXY is the Euro. I think it's 60 some percent, 62 or 4% of the DXY is the Euro. And that parity mark was a magnet for this exchange rate. So it was going to hit parity, because all the eyes were on the parity mark. And so the market just goes where everyone's kind of expecting it at that time. I thought that was very interesting. And it bounced right there. It's having a little bit of a rally, but I don't think long term the Euro is going to come back up to, say, a 120 against the dollar. I think it's also, just like the dollar is stair-stepping up, the Euro is stair-stepping down. And they also have their financial crisis going on. So if I would have zoomed this chart out, you would see that the Euro struggled during the last European debt crisis, and this coming European debt crisis, it's going to struggle as well. So the Europe, a lot of people say, oh, is Bitcoin going to maybe take market share, or the dollar's the worst currency? Is Bitcoin going to take down the dollar, then take down the Euro, then take down the Yuan or whatever? But no, I think the dollar is going to survive the longest out of these other, these national currencies. And so the Euro is going to go down before the dollar.
I mean, how do you look at what's happening in Europe and not match that conclusion, right? If you look at which country is more stable, which currency is clearly more in demand, both in contracts as well as if you just look at stable coins, you're not seeing dominance in any way or relevance in any way of the Euro unit amongst stable coins, but you're really only seeing dollar units being relevant here. So, I mean, how do you not look at Europe and get worried? And again, how do you not look at China and get worried? Like, obviously we haven't walked through all of the qualms and the issues that are happening in the United States. We have Joe Biden as our president. He's having his troubles as well. But, you know, some of the structural issues that are plaguing the world, they're just not as bad in the U.S. So when it comes to which fiat is going down first, I definitely think that, or which credit-based currency is going down first. Ansel, I saw you grimace there when I said fiat. Maybe we got to take fiat out of our lexicon. But
that's not going to happen.
Credit-based fiat is going down. Which credit-based currency is going down first? I think the euro is in trouble, definitely much more than USD.
Yeah, and there's the fragmentation risk that we talked about on the show here. With it in Europe, they don't have a fiscal policy that ties them all together. And so they have, when the economy turns bad, the global economy goes into recession, say, then it's going to affect different countries differently. So, the more indebted countries are not going to be able to deal with higher interest rates, where the countries that have a more balanced debt to GDP ratio, they are going to be able to handle these economic crises better. And we see that it's getting really bad in Italy. It looks like Mario Draghi is trying to retire or out of the being prime minister, whatever his role over there in Italy is, and they're not letting him do it. Of course, there's a populist party that is trying to take over and run Italy. And that is a fragmentation risk where Italy might leave the Eurozone. The U.S. doesn't have that same pressure. And so add that on top of all the other fundamental problems with the euro dollar or with the euro, and you can see why the euro would crash sooner than the dollar.
So I guess let's talk a little bit more about some of the issues with Europe itself, and then we can wrap up the show. But I mean, I really do believe Europe needs Bitcoin. I think that the euro has been a failed experiment for European countries. And now you're looking at the activity that the ECB is taking and the restrictions on people's money and the rhetoric from the ECB around how to kind of control and manage the population with a central bank digital currency. I really do think that the ECB is going down and Europe is going down the wrong direction. I don't know how long they're going to be able to keep it together, but I know that the longer that they continue down this direction, the worse it's going to get for European citizens. And the more Europeans are going to need to get Bitcoin, withdraw those Bitcoins, and do whatever they can to maintain their level of sovereignty. So I see people in the chat talking about financial advice. Now, I don't think that there's financial advice. I think there's life advice. Like, life advice is make sure you take care of yourself. Make sure you have sovereignty. Make sure that you're using the tools at your disposal, and make sure that you and your family are not being put in a situation that could compromise your well-being in the short to medium term. So there's been a lot of victims to really bad things happening. So what can you do to try to protect yourself? And I think Bitcoin is one of those things. So Bitcoin is absolutely one of those things. And Ansel's been talking about, as the euro has issues, the demand for dollars and U.S. equities is going to skyrocket. The U.S. financial institutions will implement their strength, but so will Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is almost like a relief valve that is permissionless, that can be owned and actually can be European, right? So like, American equities can never be European, but coin that is owned by Europeans, that is something that can kind of come back to and revitalize whatever's happening there.
Yeah, and if you go back a couple episodes, I think you got to go back on the audio version of FedWatch, where I talked about fragmentation risk in Europe, and I dove into a lot of the differences between U.S. internal fragmentation, European internal fragmentation, and then like an external global reserve currency fragmentation. And it's very interesting kind of insights that you can get from that. I think that, say, Italy wants to leave the European Union, or I would say the Eurozone, right? If they want to leave the common currency, then they have to launch their own currency. But who would they have to fight? Well, they have to fight George Soros. They have to fight Klaus Schwab, all these globalists that want to keep them in there. So they will attack the currency. Any new currency that Italy launches, it's going to be attacked into the ground by these short sellers and all that stuff. just the same way Soros tried to take down the British pound, right? Well, that the new lira in Italy will be much easier to do that to. Well, how will Italy, how can they fight against that? They back it with Bitcoin, or they back it with gold. Italy does have a lot of gold. Technically, they own gold that's held in the United States, but they could easily back it with Bitcoin. And that would be a way for these countries to get out of these monetary unions that they have, the European Union. I guess if you wanted to say everyone's on a global dollar union, because it's the dollar is the world reserve currency. If they want to do that, they could use Bitcoin to launch a new currency, or to do something like El Salvador is doing, where they have a parallel system of US dollar and Bitcoin. That gives them a tool to fight against launching of a new currency. So I think that's a very interesting idea. Also, eventually I expect the US dollar to be backed by Bitcoin, and that could be coming up in 10 years' time. We'll have to see how this develops. But to get out of a credit bubble that is pushing down with deflationary pressure, and you can't get out of a credit bubble, then you have to go to a new currency. So that's one of my big narratives. I want to shift from an inflation narrative in Bitcoin to a deflation narrative, where the only thing, as far as I can see, is low growth, low inflation in dollars, and economic crises after economic crises. And so to get out of that, you have to change the money. And that's where Bitcoin comes in. Bitcoin will change the form of the money and allow a deflationary spiral to take place. Boom.
Europe needs Bitcoin bad. The world needs Bitcoin bad, y'all. And again, like, I think the best framework to think about Bitcoin is this just independent system, right? And as Bitcoin grows, its ability to support the world economy grows, and the need for it and its ability to compete with the existing traditional systems continues to grow. So I think that Bitcoin as this alternative system is very bullish. I think the incentives are sound, things are are aligned, and economic players are going to quickly find that using the Bitcoin technological monetary stack is going to give them much better results in the future and make them more competitive with their competitors. So Bitcoin is not to be underestimated, and obviously we're bullish. So I think when you pay attention to what's happening across the globe with these central banks, with fiat monetary policy, you can tell that there's only dead ends here. So thank God for Bitcoin. And like I said, Europe needs Bitcoin. Europe can experience Bitcoin at Bitcoin Amsterdam, October 12th through the 14th. We got 3 days of Bitcoining for you there. And we're about to release a lot more details, including Bitcoin Week in Amsterdam and a lot more. So get really hyped about that. Antal, how do you want to close this one out?
I just have one more thing to add. The CBDC stuff, I think Europe will try to launch a CBDC, and that's just going to add to the fragmentation risk. It's going to add to the redenomination risk of countries like Italy, maybe the Netherlands, I don't know, France, somebody breaking off and going to a new currency. So a CBDC is definitely going to push the narrative closer and closer to Bitcoin backing of currencies. And I expect that to happen in the next couple of years. That to be a major discussion topic.
Wow, CBDCs are going to be the next blockchain decentralized ledger technology. A bunch of smoke and mirrors, a bunch of buzzwords, very little will be shipped. And then the reality is going to be they're going to find that Bitcoin was the actual signal the whole time. So I think that it started on the corporate side with blockchain technology, it ended with Bitcoin as a corporate treasury asset. And it would be incredible to see what happens there. This is a slight slide. Jesus, I can't talk right now. A slight tangent, but Obi Nwosu and a team of talented devs just raised $4 million to experiment and develop Fedimint, which is effectively a new way to leverage Bitcoin value to create unified units in order to distribute ledger in a way, or distribute value on the internet in a privacy preserving and a little bit easier way to use. So something to think about, maybe central banks leverage that technology as their way of coming up with some Bitcoin backed currency. Who knows? I think it is still very early days, but what we can say for sure is that Bitcoin is the signal here.
That's very interesting. I've seen that term Fedimint in some tweets and things, but I haven't dove into it. So does it really match Liquid? Because I expected Liquid to play a big role in adoption of nation states in Bitcoin. Do you have any insight on that? Or should I just tell me to go look
at it? I mean, that has nothing to do with Liquid, and I am grabbing some articles. One is an op-ed by Obi Nwosu about Fedi Mint, and the other is news kind of explaining what the Fedi Mint company and the raise is about. Both of those are from Bitcoin Magazine. And Q is saying that in 1 hour, they are going to have Obi on Bitcoin Magazine Spaces to talk about Fedi Mint. Q, you should ask Obi about, would governments want to use Fedi Mint? Is that something that might, a way to make Bitcoin-backed currencies that are issued by the government? So I don't know if that's something that Bitcoiners want, but definitely a question worth asking. Y'all can find me on Twitter at CK_Snarks. Obviously, always pushing shit with Bitcoin Magazine. Obviously, pushing Bitcoin Amsterdam right now and soon to be pushing Coin 2023. You can also find the Bitcoin Magazine in-print censorship-resistant issue is out. And you can get the collector's version of the subscription where you get a beautiful sealed version that you can keep for all times for the future, for future appreciation, and another copy that you can put on your coffee table, read and enjoy now. So make sure to check that out as well. Get your Bitcoin Amsterdam ticket. Ansel, I'll pass it over to you.
Yeah, just to wrap up, you guys can follow me at bitcoinandmarkets.com. I do a free weekly newsletter there every Friday that goes over all aspects of Bitcoin, including my market commentaries and rants, price analysis, mining news, and I cover macro, sometimes altcoins in there as well. Also, I started a new Telegram channel. You can find that on Telegram. Just search for Bitcoin and Markets, or I will link down in the show notes to that. That's it, guys. What is up, audio listeners? Thank you for enjoying another episode of FedWatch. Down in the show notes, you will find all the appropriate links to our social media, the original version of this podcast, and community links. Also, check out bitcoinandmarkets.com, where I put out a free weekly newsletter every Friday, and there you can also help support the show by signing up to become a paid member. See you next time.